Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino.
That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details. With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Mary redeemed a $50,000 cash prize playing Chumba Casino this year.
I was only playing for fun, so winning this was a dream come true.
Chumba Casino is America's number one social casino experience. It's serious fun. With over 80 casino-style games to choose from, you too could win life-changing amounts of cash. Be like Mary. Log on to ChumbaCasino.com and give them a whirl. That's ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void or prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
The voice in the preceding commercial was not the actual voice of a winner.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
From Autosport.com and Autosport Magazine, I'm Matt Kew, and this is the Autosport Podcast. The 100,000 fans attending the Dutch Grand Prix got exactly what they wanted as Max Verstappen pounced on Lewis Hamilton late on to secure his fourth win in a row and 10th of the 2022 Formula One season. And for those of us watching at home, we were treated to pretty much what we wanted, but might not necessarily have expected from Zandvoort, and that was an entertaining race with a proper late crescendo, which after the first sort of 8 or 9 laps didn't seem to be on the cards at all. With Podcast Martin, as he is affectionately known, on holiday for this one, please allow me to introduce our panel to dissect the race. We have Jessica McFadden, Director of Digital Strategy at the Motorsport Network, Autosport Technical Editor Jake Boxall-Legg, and live from the Netherlands, it's Autosport's F1 reporter Luke Smith. Luke, with full capacity fans this weekend, having the attendance been capped at 75% last year, give us an insight into Verstappen mania.
It's been quite something to see. I've been working in F1 for the best part of a decade now, so I was around when... That makes me sound so old, crikey. But I was around when Max came on the scene. We saw all of the European events start to have these massive influx of people wearing orange, and that wasn't because they were McLaren fans. And this was my first Dutch Grand Prix. I missed last year's one. So it was really interesting to actually see what it was like having effectively a Max Verstappen Grand Prix. And it was amazing. Like, the atmosphere all weekend has been electric. Everyone has had Max, Super Max stuck in their heads without you get no choice in that matter. It just is a thing. And and I must say that apart from the idiot who decided to throw a flare on the track during qualifying yesterday, the fans have been really well behaved. It's been really, really good. I've had a really good experience. So, and they got the result that they wanted at the end of it, which was a Max Verstappen victory and a very well-earned one as well. So, a really good weekend, I must say, here at Zandvoort.
Happy days. Glad to hear it. I thought about introducing you by talking about my experience at Zandvoort, but I thought that's not a great way to go, is it, just by making it all about me? But let's move on. We'll look straight away as a popular victory was on the cards, as Verstappen led cleanly from pole to sort of run away from turn one unchallenged. He took an early command of proceedings. There was a bit of first corner argy-bargy between Hamilton and Sainz, but otherwise it was relatively cordial between a lot of them. Leclerc was showing impressive pace to keep the gap hovering around the 1 second with that DRS prize to sort of reel in Verstappen and pounce for a potential lead. But that was until the lap counter hit the teens and then the Red Bull really started to stretch its legs up front. I'm not going to lie, that's when I was thinking about flicking on the kettle and I thought the damp squib was coming, a relatively dull race at no overtaking Zandvoort. I was ready to start drafting my column about, the 2022 regs have failed, they can't save this track, which we knew was too tight for overtaking. And the best bit at that point seemed to be actually a really snazzy new graphic where they were showing like the live time intervals and meters apart between the cars. I thought that was good. That can stay. But like Brian Spilner in the Fast and the Furious, it was a case of too soon, Junior, from me, and I was happy to be wrong. We love that reference. There's laughter.
Stuart Codling will be very proud of that kind of reference cue.
Brilliant, thank you.
Isn't that too early?
Yeah, it is a bit. Too, yeah, like, it wasn't 1980s.
That's a very recent reference.
Do you know what it was? Shout out to the, let's call it, tuned Max Power era Honda S2000 I passed on the A1 down to my folks' home at the weekend, which had Too Soon Junior written on the bottom of the rear wing as my inspiration for that. But anyway, back to Formula One and how this race became exciting. JBL, if you please, talk us through how the race sort of started to build. Was it just a case of the Mercedes, Hamilton lining up in fourth, Russell sixth? Was it just that they started on the medium tyres when all the others were on soft? Is that how this race sort of unpacked and became a good one to watch?
Yeah, I think there was a lot of strategic variation, you know, on the cards for this race before the race even began. There were a lot of drivers talking about time management, which is our favourite subject in Formula One, certainly. And you know, it was kind of on the cusp whether it would be a two-stop race or a one-stop race. That, you know, infamous Pirelli tyre graphic that comes up before each race, it was predicting two stops and that the drivers would avoid going for the hard tyre. It was suggesting those on the mediums would quickly stop for softs and those on the softs would quickly stop for mediums. It was seemed sort of pretty one-dimensional in that regard. But the hard tyre was kind of the sleeper tyre. Like, nobody really knew how good it was, but Mercedes kind of put all of its chips on that, and they were fully committed to that one-stop strategy. And that's kind of what turned it around, really. Obviously, both Mercedes cars started on mediums, and they were able to carry them sort of quite far into the race, actually. By this time, some drivers had pitted twice. I think Daniel Ricciardo would probably be, well, it was on the cusp of having pitted twice at that point. And this was kind of where it started to come to Mercedes, because the pace on mediums was quite good, but then when they bolted on the hard tyre and those two stopping were on mediums by that point and their lap times had already started to drop, Hamilton and Russell just found this rich vein of pace and they were able to light up the timing screens. They were trading fast as laps. And that was the point where I think a lot of people thought, this race isn't over. Mercedes can do something here today. If it ends up like a normal race, they would have been, you know, hot favourites to maybe pass Verstappen in the pit lane, or even under the VSC, had nobody pitted, they might have been able to carry that forward. So it was a really interesting strategy from Mercedes. They were really taking the initiative, and I think Alonso and Norris, they pitted for the hard earlier, and when they were doing good lap times, that kind of confirmed Mercedes' position in that race.
Everything that was wrong with the Merc at Spa, i.e. its draggy setup, really didn't come to the fore quite so much at lower speed Zandvoort. But before the Mercs pit to put on some hard tyres and show impressive pace, there's a small matter of Ferrari attempting to swap the soft tyres on Carlos Sainz's car on lap 14. Sainz was third at the time, but it was a 12.7 second stop as a rear left just wasn't there. It wasn't ready to be put on. And then when Sainz is finally ready to go, he gets released in front of Perez, they pause there, so there's further delay. And he comes out in 11th place, and Carlos is over team radio saying, "Oh my God." Jess, what did you make of the latest Scuderia blunder? Because at this point, if we're accepting a championship is done, is it not about showing a bit of competence? You know, in 2022 with Ferrari's strategic blunder, Is it a case of an eye roll, taking a breath and sort of whispering Kel Surprise?
You would think that they would be wanting to keep those blunders to a minimum, but yet here we are again on another podcast talking about yet more Ferrari errors. I honestly can only imagine what it must be like to be either Carlos Sainz or Charles Leclerc this season. And I'm sure, you know, it's so demoralising for anybody in any team to be making these kinds of mistakes. They're meant to be world class. And here they are making these kind of blunders. Now, I thought what was really telling was live on Sky, Binotto called it a mess. And I think that's actually the most honest that he's been this entire season, because his approach this entire time, which he's come under criticism for, is to say nothing needs to change. We just need to get it lined out. It's under control. You know, we make these mistakes to learn from them, and yet they don't. And it was the first time he's actually been hypercritical, or at least critical. Because I think actually a mess was probably not going too hard. But I mean, they explained it in that they'd made the call really, really late. So I think Carlos was already on the penultimate turn before they'd made the call. And ordinarily, if the strategists and the engineers, when they're on the pit wall, they're obviously trying to make these calls as fast as possible. But the poor mechanics in the garage need a certain window of time to be able to jump up from their seats, carry these, you know, reasonably heavy tires in tire warmer blankets and set them up ready for a car to come in order to be able to execute a pit stop properly. And the less time they have to do that, the less prepared they're going to be, the more mistakes that they're probably going to be able to make. And whilst, you know, Ferrari were trying to respond and make a call quickly in order to benefit from that, what we hear from other teams is that those mechanics, or, you know, that the chief mechanic has the ability to radio back the engineers and say, abort, we're not ready, we can't get there. And it's these little things, obviously, we're not party to that radio information. I don't know if that call was made at what point, or who, like, you know, if that similar scenario that we hear that happens at other teams happened. But, you know, it kind of goes back to what we were talking on the podcast last week, where there just seems to be a real lack of cohesion that within the Ferrari team, that no one really knows what's going on. Or when you watch Red Bull, and today was case in point, right? It looked like the win had slipped through the fingers of Max Verstappen today. And yet every call from that point that it looked like it was all over, they obviously had a little bit of help with luck, but this is Formula One. We know these kinds of things can happen at any point. And the teams that become champions are the ones that can make those opportunities work to their advantage. And to be able to do that, to be able to like take those absolute split second decisions, they need everybody in that team to almost be like one symbiotic mind. And with Red Bull and Mercedes, you feel like that is the case. I mean, with Mercedes, okay, I'm sure we're going to kind of deep dive into their strategy calls a little bit more. But you did get a sense that, you know, with their double stack pit stop went absolutely to perfection. They've just got this like level of everybody knows what it is they're doing. They work as a cohesive team. And with Ferrari, you kind of, you know, you always want to play the Benny Hill music over anything that they do. Like it just feels like it's gonna go wrong. And that's gonna be something that they're really gonna want to shift. We've not got many races left, right? Which is pretty crazy that we're already so far through the season. They're gonna want to shift that, because that meant so much of this is a mental game. And if people start believing that we're just gonna make mistakes, more mistakes happen, like mistakes breed mistakes. They cannot get in their own heads about it, but they're also not going to want to have a reputation moving into 2023 that they're just going to keep making these mistakes. But something really intrinsic needs to happen in that team to get them on the same level as Red Bull and Mercedes when it comes to
It is the basic operations that they're not getting right. And as you said, Jess, like there's not been the kind of acceptance from the team. It's always said that, oh no, it was the right call. And from the outside, it's very easy to criticize. And that was even said after today. Mattia Binotto said that about Nico Rosberg's comment, where he said, oh, even in F2 and F3, they've got all the tires ready. So I think they've really got to look at it, because this operational side, it's the basics, but you need world-class basics to be a winning operation. It's as simple as that. And Ferrari just do not have that right now. And I mean, think about, when was Ferrari's last completely clean weekend? We've had this mistake here, Spa, we saw what happened there with the sort of miscue with Leclerc at the very end of the race. Hungary was a disaster with the hard tyre. France, when Leclerc binned it. Austria, they won. They were the quickest team, but even then, we saw Sainz have the engine issue. Silverstone, we had the again another sort of strategy sort of bit of confusion towards the end of the race. So it was a real stretch of races now, and I think that really going to Monza of all races as well. I think they just need a clean weekend, even if they don't win, even if you can't properly compete with Red Bull. A clean weekend, do everything right. That's what they need to do because it's been a long streak now. And I was saying to someone earlier, like I'm getting a bit actually. Like sad even in a way that every other weekend I'm saying to Charles Leclerc, oh well, this thing happened today, you must be frustrated about it. Him going, no, we're a unified team and blah blah blah, and that's totally fine, but it's just like there's only so many times we can keep going through that process where I'm like, I want to have something good to ask you. I want to be asking you about a good thing, like, oh, that was a great move, oh, you won this race or whatever. And it's been a long time since we've been able to do that about Ferrari.
In Ferrari's partial defense, this is the first title challenge that they've been in for a number of seasons now, but when they were dominating everything on all before them in the early 2000s, that was because of a 3 or 4 year period of, you know, Michael Schumacher coming into the team and thus Benetton staff following him. So you had Ross Brawn and Rory Byrne and all of those sorts of people. One of the first things that Ross Brawn did when he started out at Ferrari was he noticed that the team was incredibly fragmented. The engine department and the chassis department barely worked together. Everybody was reading, you know, newspapers telling stories of how crap Ferrari were. And one of the first things that he did was move the engine and the chassis teams together, started this period of kind of reunification, if you like. And then, you know, by 1998-1999 they were challenging for titles, and then obviously 5 years in a row they had fantastic success. And that was, you know, it took a little bit of time, but it was this period of acknowledging that there was a problem from the higher ups, bringing in, you know, not just sort of sticking to the same mold of their hiring, but going in a slightly different direction and realizing what we're doing now and continuing to persist on the same path isn't working. Let's bring somebody else in who's been there and won championships. So they did that. And, you know, they had this period of internal investigation, and that was how they built on that success. And it seems like we're going, it's like Groundhog Day at Ferrari. It seems like we're going through the 90s again, and they have good cars, and it's just, it's not necessarily the drivers, but it's the team not making the most of it. And it's really unfortunate to see because they've got such talent in those cars, and it's just being wasted weekend on weekend.
Luke, this weekend you'll have had your elbows out in the media pen again, talking to all the drivers. Just mentioned Benny Hill earlier. Benny Hill, obviously famously in Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, in the country of Bulgaria, plays the toy maker. When Carlos Sainz, when you were chatting with him, was he throwing his toys out of the pram at the strategy blunder?
Good segue.
He did not throw his toys out of the pram. That was an excellent segue, Q. Very good job. He was pretty, I don't know, sort of pretty accepting of things. And he just put it down as being a very, very bad day because, yeah, Ferrari didn't have the pace again. And I think that's kind of the ultimate thing they've got to work on and realize that in qualifying, they were pretty close to Red Bull, but that just faded away in the race for both of them. And then, yeah, for Sainz, it was a pretty disastrous race. Obviously, we had that pit stop error that cost him so much time that sort of dropped him out of that sort of podium fight really and behind the Mercedes cars. And then we also had the unsafe release as well, which actually Sainz was most upset about. He said that he did everything he could. He said, I thought I saved somebody's life, and then I'm hit with a 5 second time penalty. So yeah, he was pretty annoyed about that. We then had the bit of confusion over his battle with Esteban Ocon and whether there were yellow flags or not. The FIA looked at that and said it was fine that there weren't yellow flags when Sainz made the move, so he was fine with that. And then yeah, at the end of all of it, the 5 second time penalty applied at the end obviously drops him down the order. And I think for Sainz, like, it was one of those weekends where in qualifying he was really there with Leclerc. Like, it looked like he was in a really, really good groove, and then it kind of all just unraveled in the race basically. And yeah, stuff like an unsafe release, that's entirely on the team. And again, it comes down to this whole team sort of processes things and everything like that, and the drivers, they can only do so much. And yeah, Sainz, he said, like, I thought I did the right thing, but it's again, Ferrari just needs to look at the whole picture, really. But Sainz was, he's pretty good at sort of taking these things on the chin. I guess that's a good thing because it's been a pretty tricky period, I think, for him and Ferrari. But yeah, they've definitely missed an opportunity here. And again, for him, okay, the championship's long gone. We know that, absolutely. But I think it's still a chance for him to get good points and be closer to Leclerc than he actually is. And yeah, this was, again, not really his doing today that led to that unravelling.
It was a scrappy race for Sainz, and he was fighting the occasion. But I have to say, over the last sort of few races, not necessarily from when he won at the British Grand Prix, but I think he's really there or thereabouts with Leclerc now. Obviously, the narrative at the start of the season was him sort of struggling with that twitchy back end on these new cars. You know how I personally rate Sainz as a really intelligent driver, really, really sort of calculating and just sort of on it. But in terms of pace now, I think he's massively closed the gap, and that has been lost today through blunders both in the cockpit and on the pit wall. But I think, yeah, kudos Sainz. He's rapid at the minute.
Yeah, and I also thought he did really well in that battle he had with Sergio Perez as well. Valtteri Bottas, he retired from the race quite early, and he came to the media pen while that was going on, and he hung around for a little bit just to watch what was going on, and he saw that move and that battle. And yeah, that was the kind of thing where Sainz didn't leave much margin for Perez, but that was what he was entitled to do. And I turned to Valtteri after we'd done our interview and everything, and that move happened, and I said, yeah, thoughts on that? Like, what was, is that completely okay? And he said, that's completely fine. Sainz was, yeah, ahead at the braking zone, ahead at the apex. You know, if you hang it around the outside, what's going to happen? So for Perez, that was all on him, basically. So yeah, that was a good bit of racecraft, I thought, from Sainz. So yeah, I'd echo what you said there, Keo. I think he's been doing all he can, and I think he's been a really, really good driver for Ferrari this year. It's good he's got that win under his belt. And I think that, yeah, they just need to string things together, really, for both him and Leclerc to maximise the end of the season now.
The stewards are operating a bit like the referees in the Premier League at the minute. They're letting a lot more of the sort of slightly robust but not way of the line stuff go at the minute. So whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, but certainly it seems a bit more laissez-faire. JBL, you like the way air rushes over winglets. Obviously, nothing as impressive as the wings on Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. But from this point onwards, it's the Mercs coming to the fore. On paper, Zandvoort is a good Ferrari track. So why are we not, from here on in the podcast, why are we going to stop talking about the red cars so much? Why were they not as quick as we thought?
That is a good question. And I'd like to say that it's one that they probably don't know the answer to. To be honest with you, it's always, Mercedes has been pretty decent at the higher downforce circuits, and it is quite a draggy car, the W13. It does have its very glaring faults, but you know, we saw the pace in Hungary, and we've seen the pace here again, and Christian Horner, speaking after the race, suggested that they'd be strong again in Singapore. So, you know, that's going to add an interesting dynamic that Mercedes even though it didn't win today, the fact that it's hinted that it can, it bodes well for them. It does kind of seem that Ferrari has perhaps underdeveloped relative to Red Bull, and for all of the strategic blunders that we've seen, there has been a very real trend, particularly over, you know, the last three or four races. There was this hugely close battle between Leclerc and Verstappen, and the fact that we're not seeing those duels that, like, we did in Bahrain, that we did in Saudi Arabia, and that Verstappen is just able to just get off and dominate in the distance, it really suggests that, you know, although Ferrari, you know, has still been pretty imperious in qualifying and was very close to taking pole again in Zandvoort, it's just lost something relative to Red Bull, and it's just not got that pace. And it's like Ferrari has not just taken its foot off the gas in terms of race operation, it's kind of done so in perhaps development terms as well. And Red Bull just seems to have found this edge, it's found its feet with these new regulations, and it's just found something extra. And, you know, we know that Mercedes is working hard on turning a W13 around, because they, if they're going to make a new change of concept for next season, they need to understand if that concept with the W13 is fundamentally flawed or not. That's something that they need to work on, and so they're, you know, still doing their development and still doing their due diligence to try and work that out. It just seems that Ferrari is just kind of sleepwalked into having the third best car. It doesn't at the moment, but it could well do if Mercedes ups its game.
Cracking analysis, JBL, but a big oversight from you there. Off air, you're talking about getting in gold member pod references. You're talking about Red Bull finding its form, taking a strike. It's found its mojo. Come on, mate. That was lying there for you. But
oh, behave.
Right. So at this point, the Mercs are on the hard tyres. Hamilton is banging in purple sectors, fastest lap. I think he's at some points 1.5 seconds a lap faster than Verstappen. Leclerc, I think, 8 seconds behind. Perez, another second, 7 seconds behind the Ferrari. But it's playing out, and we've got this stage where, okay, the race is going to have to be, at this point, settled. There's no safety car intervention. It's going to have to be settled by an on-track pass with Merckx on a one stop, Verstappen stopping again. The Red Bull is going to have to come from behind and pass Lewis Hamilton. You know, we know the narrative from last season. Jess, I'm going to throw this to you. What are you thinking at this point? Are you sort of relishing a prospect, or are you thinking, oh God, it's going to end in tears? Because this is, I mean, apart from really when Verstappen's been lapping Hamilton, in, if you're thinking like Saudi Arabia, they've not really gone wheel to wheel, and that looked like a proper prospect for this race.
It did, and especially because Mercedes seemed to be so disappointed with their qualifying performance. They really had this labelled as maybe one of their best opportunities for a win. I still can't believe we're talking about Mercedes getting a singular win or hoping for a singular win after their dominance, but here we are in 2022. So, yeah, I think it definitely got me to sit up because like you, Q, I was very much like, oh, well, here we go. This isn't exactly setting the world on fire. I mean, it's, as you say, great for Dutch fans, great entertainment for them. But for us, it was kind of like, is he just going to walk this entire season now? Like, that's no fun for anybody, including us that are paid to talk about it. But yeah, I think at that point it was like, okay, here we are. You know, we've been talking about how Lewis Hamilton has never had a season where he's had at least one win in every season, which is still a pretty mad stat to be talking about, and that this might be the year that gets broken. But there were points where we were like, no, because as we know from the race we saw last season, and yes, okay, very, very different car concepts. It's really difficult to overtake around Zandvoort. And so track position is key. So when, as you said, when we started seeing Hamilton and Russell putting in fastest lap times on the hards, that it was turning into a proper race tire. Like, it was like, okay, they're going to be pretty comfortable. They're going to be able to go to the end of the race. And even if Verstappen does have fresher rubber on, it doesn't look like, especially if they've got a Russell as a buffer between him and Hamilton, this is game, set, match, Mercedes. And it really did have that feeling, which kind of made you feel, or at least made me feel like, oh, we've got something to watch here. Like, this could be our unexpected win of the season type situation. Maybe not to the same level as like a Ricciardo winning at Monza or a Gasly winning at Monza. Monza, that is the key. That's where we're going to have it next time.
That's begging
guys,
to be clipped up on Mercedes winning, isn't it?
Right. Well, here we go. Let's have it. But it did feel like, you know, as fast as that Red Bull is, maybe it wasn't going to happen. Even if they were going to get close, and it wasn't until, I think for me, it happened a bit later on when we got Abu Dhabi flashbacks with the safety car and Max lining up behind him, and I was like, oh my God, it's going to happen again. And I...
Any or all lap cars allowed to pass the safety car.
Well, any or all lap cars. Yeah, it was a little bit flashbacky. But I purposefully stayed off Twitter for that entire section of the race. Like, very, very fortunately, we have some very great people covering off Autosport Twitter for us that I didn't have to look, because I couldn't... I was like, I don't even want to know what people are saying about this right now. But yeah, it was a bit like, well, here we go. Like, we've actually got a competitive Mercedes and, you know, very strong looking Max Verstappen. Like, where is this going to end up? So yeah, it was really exciting. And I think actually, as much as Max fully deserved this win and is clearly a class above both him and Red Bull this season, and they fully deserve the titles that they're inevitably going to win, we all do just want that whole, like, we want it to be possible for another team and another driver, especially as JBL said at the beginning of the pod, there was such a good strategy play, completely unexpected, really down to watching what other teams were doing and just taking a punt because they were out of position. So what have they got to lose? And, you know, Toto Wolff, again, doubled down on the fact that they were going to take risks and he would rather take risks and get the win this season than just kind of be safe and get second and third. Because, I mean, what are they fighting for, really? Nothing. They're not going to win the constructors, so they're not going to get any more money. And then definitely not going to win the drivers. So why not take a punt, be clever, and show that actually you've still got the package ready to go should they need to kind of pull the trigger on it. So yeah, for me, it was a little bit of an anticlimax today, as much as it was still a very, very well-deserved win from Max. I think the way that then obviously the safety car and VSC played out, it kind of, I feel a little bit robbed today because I kind of just wanted to talk about a different winner. But that just goes to show just how dominant Max and Red Bull have been this season. And
dear listener, I promise you we're getting to that crescendo shortly. But I want to talk about a couple of the sort of trials and tribulations for Hamilton on, that, on his way to sort of potentially challenging for the win. And that was, first off, his battle with Sergio Perez. So on lap 36, it's into turn one. Perez all weekend up to this point, and it's a bit of a theme over the last sort of half dozen races. He's just not been there. You know, another reference for you, JBL. His contract effectively says act like a mini me to Verstappen. You know, you have to be that rear gunner, pick up the pieces.
I was going to ask if Max has made a little papoose for him to sit in.
Well, I don't know, but no. Sergio Perez has obviously been being paid more than the princely sum of $1 million. But as part of his role, he needs to be the rear gunner and play that. And he wasn't doing that at all until into lap one, where he does sort of just, he's robust with Hamilton. He forces Hamilton wide and delays that overtake another lap. And then when Hamilton does get by, because he's lost that sort of, you know, second battling with Perez, he's then held up for the entire first sector from Vettel, who comes out of the pit lane and is slow. And they go side by side through the bank turn three. And I think Vettel does then get a penalty for ignoring blue flags. But again, it looked at that point, what are those 3-4 seconds for Hamilton? What are they going to do? How is it playing out? Luke, what did you make of it at the time? The media centre is probably maybe underrated. That's something I've learned covering F1. It gets a few sort of whoops and cheers at key moments in the race. What was the reaction like at that point when Vettel was making his Aston Martin particularly wide?
Yeah, it does. But it's a funny media centre at Zandvoort because it's kind of like lots of different rooms, if that makes sense. So we were in quite a small room with lots of all of our colleagues, obviously, from Autosport and Motorsport.com, but as well as, quite a few Dutch journalists. And I think they were quite enjoying that fight because obviously, as you said, sort of Perez would be helping Max Verstappen out. And I agree. Like, I think the more the race wore on, the more we're thinking, hang on, the Mercs are actually coming into this because the hard tyre was showing such little degradation that the times was looking really, really good, really consistent. It was a tyre that nobody was expected to use. And even when the Alpines were the first to move on to it and everyone kind of went, hang on a minute. And I actually said that to Esteban Ocon after the race. He was like, oh, we always knew we were going to do that. And it was as though they had a little trick up their sleeve. And I think that the more it wore on, the more everyone saw how good that tyre was. But I think the Mercs made it work really, really well. And I think that it was always, it was inevitable that Lewis was going to get Checo at one point. But I think I even tweeted that it was a return of Mexico's Minister of Defense, which is obviously the moniker he got given after his brilliant display in Abu Dhabi last year that ultimately did help Max win the title. And it was, obviously not quite to the same extent, but it was, it was very robust. And that's kind of, really, that's probably the best part of Perez's race, to be honest. Like, he's not been on the pace that Max has showed at all this weekend. I know that's a very high bar set, but you should be doing better than P5 when you've got the quickest car. It's as simple as that. So, I think we were looking at it, though, and thinking that, okay, we knew Max had to come in again, and it was really just a question of when he would come in, if he was going to go for the hards, just how much of a delta would he have built up in terms of laps, and would that actually be enough to be able to get past both Mercedes? And it would have been tricky, but as I'm sure we're going to come on to the virtual safety car and we could talk about a bit what about Red Bull's plan and who the VSC worked against and things like that, but it was at that stage, you were definitely thinking Merck have got a shout here, like they're not going quietly.
I think to be blunt about it, fifth place for Perez today, these kind of performances,
if it's pre-Monaco at the end of last year, these are the sort of drives that meant that Albon, Gasly, Kvyat were relieved of their duties, effectively, or certainly I think so. But at this point, there's a really interesting dilemma for Verstappen. The Mercs are really quick, but he says, I don't want the medium tyres. And this is when the lap count is sort of in the early 40s. I don't want the medium tyres, but softs, I've got 30 laps to go. I can't make it to the end of the race on those. And then hards, if the Mercedes pit again or something, I'm going to be prey on the slowest tyres. And then he gets a bit of respite. The strategist, you know, the camera straight on Hannah Smith, because there is a virtual safety car for a whole sort of, well, eventually a virtual safety car. It starts off as yellow flags for some sort of odd stuff going on with Yuki Tsunoda. At first, it's the tyres are incorrectly fitted, and then it's the belts, and then it's a differential. Which one of you three wants to try and unpack that? Jess, I know at this point you're back on social media because the conspiracy theories are flying. So lay it on us. What's happening there with AlphaTauri?
Yeah, it was so bizarre. So the too long didn't read version, Yuki thinks there's something wrong with the tyres, so he pulls over. Well, the engineer tells him to pull over, and they're like, right, we've got to stop the car because you can't be going around if we don't think we've fit the tyres properly. So at which point, I'm sure he thinks, well, that says gone. But the team look into it and they go, no, there's nothing wrong. Like, the tyres are fine. You're fine. Car's fine. Like, maybe just come back to the pits. We'll check it out. So at that point, and this is where the conspiracy theory starts kicking in real hard, and I honestly want to burn Twitter whenever I see stuff like this start to fly around. But anyway, so he makes his way back to the pits. They change the tyres because why not? Like, they're going to have to change strategy because he's basically down a lap now. And we see him fiddling with the cockpit. So checking the steering, because Yuki was reporting, or maybe it's the steering, because I'm just feeling something really weird, like something's not quite right. And then we see them fiddling with the seat belts. So there is still a question mark as to, you know, AlphaTauri have come out and said the seat belts weren't undone, but Yuki had started to loosen them presumably because he thought he was jumping out of the car. But he says he didn't undo them. So that's all meant to be legal. The FIA has deemed it such. I mean, he has been reprimanded for unsafe driving, but not to do with the seatbelts. So they send him out again, and within half a lap, he's pulled over again. I mean, I don't think he ever got back up to speed, really. He pulls over to the side of the road again and says, there's something wrong with the rear now. It might be the differential. And that's what AlphaTauri is currently saying was the problem. But they are investigating as to why it was. But very, very, very strange run of events. But I guess, you know, the conspiracy theories are, oh, well, you know, sister team of Red Bull. That's highly convenient, right? Highly convenient that comes. And I think I actually feel really bad for Hannah Schmitz at this point, because I think we saw the kind of, I can't remember how many, I don't know if it was exact the right time, but pretty soon after Yuki had stopped out for the second time and the VSC had been called, it cut to the Red Bull pit wall and Hannah Schmitz was smiling. And again, the conspiracy theorists have now caught on to the fact, well, you know, she knew what was going on. But there's nothing to say that she goes, no, now the strategy is going to come our way. But I'm sure Luke's actually going to jump in here, because the theory is actually that entire scenario where a VSC was called, where actually I think a lot of us thought maybe a full safety car would be called because of the car on track. And the Zandvoort situation is that the marshals actually find it really difficult to manoeuvre the cars because it's in a sand dune, the racetrack. So they can't push the cars freely. They have to use cranes for the most part because they physically cannot move the cars on their own using just human power. But as I'm sure Luke's going to dive into, because he's done a video all on it for me already, is that the VSC caused by Yuki Tsunoda could actually have cost Verstappen.
That's according to Christian Horner. Because we spoke after the race, and obviously I'd seen these sort of theories and whatnot floating around, and seen the comments from Toto Wolff as well on Sky saying sort of, yeah, Tsunoda, and I think visible confusion was the motorsport.com tweet sort of summing up his mood. And but Horner actually explained that, as Matt, you were saying, that Verstappen didn't want to take the hard tyre. That was very, very clear, because it was a tyre that they didn't know and they're very unsure about. So the plan was always to extend that stint out, get close enough to the end of the race that you can make it home on softs, except that you're going to lose track position to both of the Mercedes cars, but you're on a much, much quicker tyre. We know how quick the track at Zandvoort rubbers in and it make a huge gain. And yeah, Verstappen will be able to fly past both of them. Zandvoort goes absolutely crazy and it's another race win. But the VSC, that threw all of that out of the window. The Red Bull really had to go, well, okay, we've got to come in, we've got to come in. So although it did actually give Verstappen protection in terms of the track position, that he was able to pit, take the hard tyre, and then still be ahead of both of the Mercedes cars instead of dropping behind them. Because under a VSC, obviously the whole field is moving slower. That means that drivers make up less time when someone comes into the pits. So it's in your favour to always pit under a VSC if you can, like a situation like that. But it forced him to go for the hard tyre. And Horner said that, yeah, it was a real... He said it came at the worst possible moment, which was quite an interesting way to word it. Again, particularly given all of these sort of theories and stuff going around. And it meant that they were on a strategy they didn't want to do. Verstappen was on a tyre he didn't want to be on. And that they all suddenly had to go, well, how do we cope with this? And I think that if you look at what everyone else was doing, it would have been fine. And I think there wouldn't have been any issues at all getting to the end of the race. Obviously, we had the later safety car still to come. But yeah, it was interesting that there was such concern for Mercedes that, okay, we're going to be, sorry, such concern for Red Bull that we're going to be in a position where Max is, yeah, he's up against it, that we're not on the right tyre, and that as, yeah, if we have another curveball later on, that we've got to then choose, well, do we go for track position or the correct compounds? So, yeah, a difficult situation for Red Bull is Red Bull's version of events. But then, yeah, you talk to Mercedes and they say, well, actually, no, the VSC cost us more because, yeah, we'd have had more of a chance to be in the fight. We'd have had both cars ahead of Max and there was little deg on the hards. That meant we could have hopefully held him off. So it's quite interesting, that disagreement. And again, these teams that have got strategists who've won championships and obviously are so successful, and both of them can look at one situation and have completely different views on it.
The detail that's maybe slightly lost is that Leclerc has already pitted at this point before it becomes a full-blown, or before it becomes a virtual safety car, a full-blown safety car. So he has like the most expensive pit stop. It's the most, you know, the most time, it takes the longest amount of time, if you like. And then I'm going to try and keep things brief now as I rattle through some of the events that happen over the next sort of few laps. So Verstappen starts for hards. Mercedes do that lovely double stack. Okay, maybe there's a tenuous reference there. Jess, you talked about conspiracy theories. I'm reading a really interesting book on the origin of conspiracy theories. The earliest recorded one is in Norwich. And you might think I'd stick to form and make an Alan Partridge reference there, but no, I'll say Norwich in the beautiful county of Norfolk, where Russell's from. Russell, obviously, second in that wonderful, wonderfully orchestrated double stack.
We are getting ever more into Stuart Codling territory tonight, Q.
Compliment taken.
I feel like I'm in a game of like, what was that game of like 6 degrees or something? Yeah. You know, when you have to like go from one. I feel like I'm in a game of that. Which, yeah, this is. I'm here for it. I'm here for it, Q.
It's what the listeners want. But anyway, so because the Mercs do this double stack, it then hands Verstappen track position, and not only is he in on track position with tyres of the similar age, but he's also in a quicker car. So that looks then like the win has fallen away from Mercedes. So, you know, this thing that Jess and I were talking earlier about, yes, it's finally going to be settled on track. That's where the race is building. We lose that and we think that's gone. Even Hamilton says at some point over team radio, the VSC has stuffed us. Obviously, his team radio will get a bit more colourful later on, but that comes after he's praising the pit stops early in the race and how we've nailed it. He then sort of settles into it and realises, oh, no, it's taking it away from us. So we've got to the point from where it was Verstappen having to come from behind to pass Hamilton. Now it's Hamilton in the slower car must pass Verstappen. Suddenly at Zandvoort, that looks less likely. I mean, you know, have we lost a crescendo of this race? It's building so nicely. But then Bottas stops. So we have the safety car come out. Jess, were the Ferrari conspiracy theorists equally as vocal, or the anti-Ferrari camp saying Bottas stopping now Leclerc's come away with a podium? It must all be linked as part of the Illuminati's grand plan for us all.
It did feel weird that the two sister teams of the two, well, at least one top team and one should have been top team. It did feel weird, didn't it? Like it did feel like, and at one point I even thought like, oh, has Bottas just kind of like helped his old team? Only for a second, and then you realise, oh no, this is absolutely going to send them up the swanny, really. But yeah, it did feel, I feel like maybe not as much of a conspiracy theory, but I mean, I genuinely had to stop reading how many conspiracy theories were coming out over the course of this race. I think we just all got very excited that stuff was happening. That's what I'm going to put it down to. Like, that's the only perfectly logical explanation that I can put to why this came out. But no, it did. I don't think it didn't. Well, it did help, as you say, Leclerc get a podium, because it did then lead to the next string of events where I think we have to commend Russell, as selfish as it sounded, which I thought was the perfect juxtaposition. He was very, very strong in his call. Which is something that we've said that maybe Leclerc needs to do more of, because he said, put me on the softs. I want the softs. I'm losing these tires. We have to do this or this is all over, in a very shorter, much shorter radio message than I've just tried to reenact. But that call got him P2. And without it, you would argue that the Mercedes would have dropped off completely and not even been on the podium at all. But it did feel like a very selfish move, because what that then meant was that there was no buffer at the restart from Hamilton to Verstappen. What year am I in? Vettel? Yeah, it meant there was no longer a buffer from Hamilton to Verstappen. But afterwards, and then we all know how good George is at being towing the PR line, I was trying to tally how many times he said, we, team, us. It was the whole language was, even when he was asked about his own call, he reflected it back, bounced it back, team, Mercedes, us, we, never me, never I, never taking credit for the fact that it was his decision to go onto the soft to keep his position and mean that he went home with the podium, which I found like very interesting. Just as a side note to the turnout of events that came to be.
A few things to rattle off, I think, are with the safety car, so we don't have to dissect them all. But you know, I neglected to mention Bottas stops on the run to turn one. He's on the inside there. His engine lets go. I think that's a basic explanation, isn't it? You just hear it sort of buzz and pull up. And then Sainz and Ocon side by side under yellow flags. So Ferrari gets ahead, and Sainz again, me, you know, sort of praising him for being so intelligent. He does that sort of cheeky thing of he passes Ocon and then sort of queries it over team radio. And I in my notes, I wasn't sure how to describe it. I put tactical innocence proclaiming, because he was just like going, oh, I'm not sure about that, but oh, that's me. Oh, there's nothing I could have done. And sort of, it's like, I think, you know, previously, I think actually for that manoeuvre, he would have been banged to rights. Not now, whatever, they've softer position on it. But I like that he was sort of stating his innocence and querying it over team radio and sort of flagging that already, which I thought, again, pretty shrewd. We had Alonso, I think it was it locking up into turn one and under the safety car and with the battle with Norris, which was entertaining. But we'll get to lap 56. Verstappen comes in for softs. Hamilton stays out, has track position. Just as you've summed up, Russell's calling the shots. He dives in for softs. Perez pits as well. And so we've now got this situation where, yes, Hamilton has the track position, but we know that the Merc is got much older tyres, and we know it's weak at tyre warm-up. So you've got it behind the safety car, and as well, some of the best restarts we've this season, I think back to Leclerc in the first couple of races, when he goes, he chose to do it from like a proper kink, so that when he was in a straight line, like the car behind where it was Verstappen had a bit like an armful of steering lock on, so he couldn't get on the power immediately. Hamilton here, because it's sort of a DRS, you can have DRS through the final corner because it's so wide and open. He doesn't really have that luxury. So as soon as he's on the power, Verstappen's on the power as well, in the tow, and with the best overtaking opportunity into turn one. So it wasn't quite the three or four lap dice we were expecting. It was Verstappen just nails it for the effective victory at that point. JBL, what did you make of events? I suppose at that point you can start sort of declaring Verstappen will win this, but you know, was it a satisfying sort of conclusion to the race, that the way he just nails Hamilton at the restart?
Oh, it was pretty much game over at that point, wasn't it? You know, much has been spoken about with regards to Mercedes' strategy, I think in that situation, you know, Verstappen wins in every permutation. You know, even if Hamilton could have switched the tires on, yeah, I think Verstappen would have, by measure, just got him a little bit later on. You know, and if both cars stay out, Verstappen will probably pass them both. If both cars pit, they can see the position to Verstappen. So I don't really see a permutation where Mercedes can win it at that point, which is unfortunate. But, you know, Verstappen very much had the lay of the land. With regards to the restart as well, if you watched any of the junior category races, because there were a lot of safety cars across F2 and F3 this weekend, there was quite a, let's say, fracas.
Did Jeremy Clarkson punch one of the drivers?
Yeah. Well, it was as if Jeremy Clarkson had punched one of the drivers into a wall, because Liam Lawson led the restart, and he went very, very late, just as they were coming off that banking, actually. In most of the races, you'd see the driver just come out of that sort of weird, horrible chicane that I hate, and then get on the throttle. So luckily, we didn't have that. We didn't have the Lawson pile up. Verstappen just had so much more tyre life and he could just get going on those softs, and Hamilton on old mediums, they're hard to warm up. They're a lot more solid. You can't get the energy through them, even through that banking. It's really, really hard. So yeah, that was game over for Hamilton really at that point. And just to touch back on what Jess said as well about Russell calling that strategy after the race in the press conference, he said something along the lines of, well, you know, it suited us better to split our strategy and have two cars on it. It's like, well, who's making that call? The team? You? It's like George is backseat driving, which, fair play to him, he made the right call and he got the job done. He passed Hamilton, and that got slightly messy as well. By the restart, it was pretty much obvious who was going to win at that stage.
Yeah, Russell really had to check his pace to avoid a massive shunt between the two marks. Luke, I'm going to come to you now. A very different narrative from Hamilton by the end of it, talking about, guys, you've really nailed the pit stops. Then he says, you fluffed my race, you bunch of dossers and dwads. There's your Alan Partridge reference. It's worth waiting for. But That's really different to the Hamilton we've seen all season, which has been, oh, you know, I back you guys completely to get it done. And I'm not saying that in the instance he's sort of you know, given up hope on what Brackley and Brixworth are capable of, but Hamilton certainly in that moment seemed to go in on the team a little bit more. Did he have time to process it when he was then speaking outside of the car later? Where was his head at, basically?
Yeah, he did have time to process it, and it's quite funny how after a week ago, when it was Alonso running his mouth and Lewis being on the receiving end of it, and Lewis sort of saying, like, oh, well, yeah, sort of nice to know what he thinks of me and things like that, that now it's Hamilton who was the man being focused on for what he was saying over the radio. But he was, he came away from that saying, look, no, I realised now, and yeah, I apologise for those comments. And I think sort of reaffirming the, as you say, it's about we win and we lose together and that whole mentality. And he said, like, I'm passionate, I care. Like, that's why I will say these things, because I just want to win and I see a chance for us to do well and it slips away. And it was interesting to see that, because as you say, it's so against the sort of what we're used to from Lewis over the radio, particularly, and that sort of unity that we normally see. But yeah, I think he did go away and process it. And it's also one of these things that I think you talk to teams and engineers and things like that, they're used to it. They know that, okay, like what you say over the radio, I'm not going to take it to heart. Go away, cool down for 15 minutes, get the race done. Yeah, then we can talk about it and like see where your head is actually at. Toto Wolff, he said that it was a beautiful turn of phrase. He said teams have to accept being vomit bags for their drivers and know that they're just going to be on the receiving end of blah, blah, blah on the radio, and that's how it is sometimes. But then, yeah, you come away and you talk about it and you say, okay, well, this could have been done better, or this is why we did what we did, and you understand it. And earlier this year, I had a good chat to Jody Eggington, who's the technical director at AlphaTauri. We were talking about Yuki and his radio, and he said, I'm used to it. I've been working with racing drivers for 20 years, and someone who's mouthy over the radio, that's absolutely fine. Like, you just know that as long as out of the cockpit, they're fine. It's okay. So, it was interesting. It was, yeah, you could just see how flustered Lewis was. But I think, again, it's the fact that he cares. It's the fact that that was their one chance so far this season to probably snatch a race win, and it had been taken away from him, and he didn't understand why. So, yeah, you can understand it, but yeah, just, it was just interesting to see because it was so unlike what we're used to.
One point, and not to labour the call too much, but we talked earlier, you know, I went in on Ferrari, another strategy shambles. We talked about that. Is it right then that we should also pick apart Mercedes a little bit? Because effectively what they did is they banked track position on the slow old tyre and lost, which is what Ferrari did with Leclerc at Silverstone. So is it fair to draw that comparison and go in at Mercedes, being as we've been harsh on Ferrari?
I would say no, because Mercedes aren't fighting for a championship. And yeah, they had to roll the dice. As Jess said, Wolf was very clear that I don't want to be here banking second and third and just accepting that's how it is. Like, we want to go all out for victory. We want to try and do what we can to win the race. And their thinking was, look, the medium that Lewis is on, it's not done that many laps. So if it holds up pretty well, then maybe we'll be able to fend off Max. Maybe that him on those fresh softs won't be that much of an advantage. And I think what was the surprising bit for many, and this was again something that Christian Horner talked about, was that they did split the strategies and that Russell came in as well, and that meant there was no rear gunner to protect Sir Lewis, because maybe that might have made things a bit different. I don't know. But yeah, I think it just is a little bit different, because Ferrari at Silverstone, they weren't a team desperately going for their one race win this season that will absolutely make their entire year. They were a team fighting for a championship who basically were thinking, well, what do we do? What do we do? And they have, yeah, one lead driver in the championship who they probably should have backed and didn't. Mercedes, does it really matter who out of Hamilton and Russell wins the race this season? I don't think so, just as long as they do win one.
So out of all of this, Verstappen crosses the line to win over Russell by 4 seconds. I want all three of you to give an opinion here, and me being the host, I don't have to, so I can sit nicely on the fence. Verstappen, I think it's pretty uncontroversial to say Spa was the best win of his career because of from how far back he comes. But he's doing that at a car at a track which allows overtaking in a car that is demonstrably quicker. So from where the Red Bull was breaking down in FP1, slow in FP2, should we be, you know, rating this Verstappen win sort of similarly highly, considering at no overtaking Zandvoort, he overtook and he took control and he had an answer for it? Yes, circumstances played in his favour to an element, but, you know, is this another top draw performance from Verstappen, do we think? Jess, let's start with you.
It really does depend, because I think today was a case of Red Bull and Verstappen just being faultless and taking advantage. But we could equally be having a very different conversation had those VSCs and safety cars not happened. It looked like actually they'd let it slip because they hadn't counted on another team being as bold as Mercedes. So I know it's all if, buts and maybes, but I think in terms of an individual performance, yes, you're totally right in saying that Spa is an easier track to overtake in, but it just looked like Max was on another level. And, you know, Red Bull still provided everything that Max needed to do, but as a driving performance, it was still mightily impressive. Spa, this kind of, I guess this is why it's so difficult to compare drives, because there are always in F1 different variables to consider. But I think in terms of impressiveness, whilst I definitely do see what you are getting at, I think for me as an individual, if we're talking about Max Verstappen the racing driver, Spa will still be just that bit more impressive, just because you got to see the magic of Max, because other drivers were still struggling to overtake. And okay, yeah, you go, well, he's in the fastest car, and blah, blah, blah. But, you know, I think that last week Spa was similar to Hamilton, Brazil. And I think, whilst I maybe wouldn't say that Brazil was his best, Hamilton's best race, I think we're still yet to see Max Verstappen at his absolute best, which is probably a terrifying thought. I think he's going to be faced with more challenges where we will see more Hamilton-esque comebacks, which I'm really excited for. But yeah, for me, I think Spa tips it for me as a driving performance.
Yeah, it is terrifying, isn't it? With any, like, you know, whether it's Football Manager or whatever strategy game, you assemble the best components, don't you? And at the minute, it's difficult to look past Verstappen as the driver operating at his peak at the minute and the RB18 being the best car out there, and then Red Bull's operations being the slickest of the lot. So you put those, and that's quite the sort of three-pronged attack. Luke, JBL, what did you rate of Verstappen's performance? And I'm looking at the time now, and I know you need to wind down. I'm starting to feel guilty because we barely touched on any of the midfield. So are there any unsung heroes from the race that we need to shout about? Because I, as your host, have failed to do so.
Honestly, Matthew, how do you sleep at night?
In a racing car bed with my wife.
Very good. It was either that or it was going to be the radio. Is it Radio Wolfcastle? And he's like on top of a big pile of money with beautiful women.
Lots of beautiful ladies.
Dear. That's it. Yeah. quite similar to Toto Wolff in a voice, actually, isn't he? But anyway, we've got very sidetracked there. Fernando Alonso, who's a driver who we've spoken about the Fernando Alonso tax before and how some of his performances can maybe be over-egged a little bit, but no, he was brilliant today, I thought. We saw in qualifying, it was a difficult day for Alpine, and he dropped out in Q2, but he fought his way back up the order well. He was one of the first drivers on the move, picking off both the AlphaTauris. And then, yeah, that switched to the hard tyre. It was a really, really good decision by Alpine, and then he bolted on a set of softs later on. They were going to go for a real sprint to the finish. And then he said when he saw the safety car, he was like, oh no, because everyone else was doing the same thing. But I think to come away with sixth place, I think, is a really good performance for him. It was a pretty close battle with Norris as well. But no, I thought Alonso did a really good job today. Esteban Ocon as well, getting up into the points. He regretted that he wasn't his pace in the first stint. He didn't get as much out of it as he would have liked, but otherwise he reckons he could have been up there with Fernando as well. And I would also like to give a rare but welcome shout out to Lance Stroll as well, because to be P10, I thought was a really good job for him. And he was actually a bit disappointed because he thought that, Aston Martin had more pace this weekend, but things, the late safety car again worked against him a little bit. In qualifying, there was an issue in Q3 that meant he couldn't get out. So, all three of those drivers get up into the points, I think, have done a really good job today.
I guess Luke has left me with shout outs for those who didn't have such a good weekend. I think AlphaTauri had a bit of a miserable weekend, and it's night and day over last season, isn't it? The car in 2021 seems so good. Pierre Gasly had P6 on lockdown every qualifying session, and now they're struggling to get out of Q1. It's not consistent. No points for the team. They're on, I think, 29 points, and I think Aston Martin's on 25, where given their relative positions at the start of the season, that's really not particularly good. As Luke said, Lance Stroll did have a very good day and, you know, possibly could have had more had qualifying gone to plan. Mick Schumacher dropped out of the points. No points for Haas. Just struggled with pit stops. And then teammate Kevin Magnussen, who was knocked out in Q1 on Saturday, clunked the wall at the start of the race and somehow made it through the race unscathed, which was, you know, a fair feat. But it's such a strange season for Haas. It started with so much promise. We were like, yes, they're back. They're going to be, you know, the surprise team of the season after a dreadful couple of years. And now they just seem to be slipping into midfield obscurity again. And then I guess it's also worth mentioning the travails of the recently displaced McLaren driver Daniel Ricciardo, finishing P17.
Did any of you guys see JV? Like, there was a Twitter clip that emerged. Yeah, where you can overhear Ricciardo essentially saying, "I'll take a year out and come back in 2024," which he obviously didn't know he was being filmed. We obviously don't have anything official on that. It obviously is at this point unconfirmed hearsay, but that is what it sounds like he's saying. It looks more and more likely that he is not going to have a Formula One seat next
season. Was that the one with the caption that says Daniel Ricciardo struggling again McLaren on it? Which was allegedly apparently an official F1 TV little lower third for him, and it said struggling again McLaren on it, which is...
Oh, it did! Yes, yeah. No, it did! It wow. did! I mean, that is just...
Also, I know what a lower third is.
The little lower thirds. Yeah, well done, JBL. You've been working with Matt enough times. They sometimes go full savage on people. Like, they'll say something hasn't improved this season, or, you know, like they just put like the most savage strap lines in, and I don't know who does it, but, you know, fair play to whoever has the balls to do that and put it on live TV. But yeah, it like the Ricciardo one was pretty surprising. I think, you know, you would think the drivers are aware that whenever they're walking, they have a camera and a microphone not too far behind, whether that's Netflix or F1 TV or a broadcaster. But it does seem like they got a little bit caught out. So a little bit like we overheard Perez saying, oh, maybe I signed too early. We might be forcing Ricciardo into revealing his plans for next year, which might be, I don't have any.
It's interesting on the mention about sort of mics and things like that. And now team principals, I think, are actually mic'd up pretty much all of the time when Netflix is following them. And I've heard a couple of instances this weekend where we've gone to speak to a team principal and us and our colleagues, and they've gone, oh no, I can't talk, I'm mic'd up. And or if they want to talk, they'll be like, right, how do I quickly undo this so I can talk to you off record without being picked up by a microphone? It's quite interesting. But yeah, I think the other big, obviously, thing this weekend has been the driver market. I think we've seen so much movement with that, with the CRB ruling about Piastri and his confirmation at McLaren, and Pierre Gasly now moving towards Alpine. Colson Herta looks set for an AlphaTauri drive if they can get the breakthrough on the super license. But there's a bit of concern, I think, from some teams and even Formula One about basically what's the point of a rule book if you don't follow it and you need to make exceptions. And the doors are shutting for Daniel Ricciardo, unfortunately. And yeah, it's been a pretty miserable weekend for him on track, and not much better off track either. I think that the way things are looking, is it Haas and Williams? Is that the best he can do for next season? It kind of looks that way right now.
And if, you know, the Williams door is shut, if they do go with Logan Sargeant, or if they go with Nick...
Who, if I may jump in, seems to be doing everything in his power to not get a Williams drive for next season after, another pretty bad Formula 2 weekend for him.
Well, all of the contenders for that seat haven't had particularly good years. Logan Sargeant, it's not been a bad start to life in F2. It is still his first season, but he had a pretty dreadful weekend in Zandvoort. People link Nick de Vries with the seat, and he impressed the team in free practice, but his Formula E season, which I've been on the front lines for, selfish plug, it's not been particularly special. It wasn't as good as the season that he gave Mr. Q, formerly of that parish. And Haas, considering Antonio Giovinazzi, who possibly had one of the worst Formula E seasons that anyone has ever had. Scraping the barrel at this point, isn't it?
I was actually quite disappointed how hard Domenicali came out and said, we won't look into it, because I do get their point. You know, there are rule books there. And I guess the point that we do want to avoid is we don't want to set precedent whereby we look back and go, well, everybody who has achieved the same as Colton Herta or similar then all automatically gets awarded super license points, because it would be a bit of a frenzy and probably not a very nice process for the FIA to have to go through with the influx of applications. But it did smack to me, and maybe I've taken this the wrong way, but it smacked to me of F1 preserving its own European-centric ladder of Formula 3, Formula 2, Formula 1. And it's something that, you know, there's been all this talk about Andretti coming in and bringing US audience, and then an American driver coming in and bringing audience. And obviously they've said, oh yeah, Logan Sargeant's fine because he's from our little family of European series. But as we well know, there are only 20 seats on the Formula One grid. And how many amazing drivers have come through the Formula 3, Formula 2 ladder, got to the end and gone, well, that's it. Where do I go? And where else do they go but potentially to IndyCar or whatever? And I know, like, you know, Colton Herta is somebody that has been in the European circuit. He's got that level of experience that some of the other IndyCar drivers maybe don't have. But I think it's really, I hope I'm not just being too cynical, but I feel like if we are going to stop having these issues of these bottlenecks of too much talent coming in and not enough seats to put them in the pinnacle of racing, then, you know, there's something has to be done. Like, something has to kind of, and we don't want to ever be in a situation where, as JBL said, we're looking at bringing in the dregs because nobody else qualifies. Like, that, again, is not what is meant to be the pinnacle of motorsport. And to Christian Horner's point, they're only going to let Gasly move on, which has been so overdue in terms of him moving away from the Red Bull pool. And they will not let that happen unless they have exciting talent. Now, Red Bull have some of the most amount of young drivers on their roster than anybody else. So if they're saying that there's nobody in their pool of drivers that's exciting enough to let Gasly go, and they're looking externally to IndyCar, something is severely broken here. And I think we've known this for a long time, right? But I think Domenicali's comments just really got my back up, because I'm like, well, what do you want? Seriously, what do you want here? Do you want to go big in the US or not? And I think, yeah, it's just been a very, very weird year of, we don't want Andretti, we don't want to recognise IndyCar drivers as having a similar weighting to the most junior of junior categories. They don't even have the equivalent of in terms of super licence points. It blows my mind. And I really hope we fix it. And I really do, you know, it would be interesting to see how an IndyCar driver gets on in Formula One. That's not a reason to bend the rule book. I do understand that that can't just, you know, just happen and we do it because it fits the narrative. But yeah, something is not right. Something's got to give. And Oscar Piastri is another great example of they said that the young driver academies aren't broken. I beg to differ.
Perhaps that's a post Bernie Eccleston era, isn't it? When it's not someone's specific train set anymore, you have to play it by the books. But yeah, thank you very much for that. I learned a lot. But I think that dissects most of the important key points from the Dutch Grand Prix, and then straight into the final one of this triple header with Monza, which again, as we've had some surprises at the past, obviously Gasly and Ricciardo winning last season. I don't know. It's hard to say though, isn't it? Because you know, you look at the straight lines, you think maybe the Williams has a chance of doing well there, but the best engine in the straight line is that Honda engine, and it's powering Max Verstappen. So we'll see what happens there. Be sure to join us on the podcast next time out as we dissect that. But in the meantime, this is your reminder to head to autosport.com, where Luke will be rifling through all the breaking news from the Dutch Grand Prix and any further shenanigans that take place over the next 7 days. And then you need to come back tomorrow morning. We'll have our full Grand Prix report, and then tomorrow afternoon the driver ratings will go live, and on Wednesday and Thursday you'll have the opinion columns, and then on Thursday Autosport magazine hits shelves. Surely enough to keep coming back and back. But thanks very much for listening, and join us again next time for another episode of the Autosport Podcast.
Mary redeemed a $50,000 cash prize playing Chumba Casino this year.
I was only playing for fun, so winning this was a dream come true.
Chumba Casino is America's number one social casino experience. It's serious fun. With over 80 casino-style games to choose from, you too could win life-changing amounts of cash. Be like Mary. Log on to ChumbaCasino.com and give them a whirl. That's ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void or prohibited by law. 18+. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details. The voice in the preceding commercial was not the actual voice of a winner. Mary redeemed a $50,000 cash prize playing Chumba Casino this year.
I was only playing for fun, so winning this was a dream come true.
Chumba Casino is America's number one social casino experience. It's serious fun. With over 80 casino-style games to choose from, you too could win life-changing amounts of cash. Be like Mary. Log on to ChumbaCasino.com and give them a whirl. That's ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void or prohibited by law. 18+. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details. The voice in the preceding commercial was not the actual voice of a winner.
Reach new career heights with University of Maryland's Robert H. Smith School of Business. Flexible MBA and MS options. GMAT and GRE not required. Learn more at go.umd.edu/smithschool. University of Maryland Smith School of Business. Inspired, fearless, unstoppable.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.